sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Harriet Rosetto, the 2013 Kohan Award winner for her work in Jewish recovery from addiction and imprisonment, and the founding of Beit Teshuvah. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The heat of summer remains in full force in most places in America during these dog days of August, but school has begun here in southern Arizona, where I live, nonetheless, and in many other parts of this country as well. I'm really more than a little puzzled by the fact that in Tucson, Arizona, some school districts actually began their fall semester the last week of July, which is not fall by anybody's standards, while many districts in our neighboring state of California don't start until September. Colleges also have a wide range of start dates, ranging from early August to October. None of these different beginnings to the fall semester seem related to weather or geography or educational philosophy at all. I mean, the Sonoran Desert isn't cooler or more comfortable in August than it was in late May, and a lot of California is pretty much the same weather all year round. So why do the school districts here begin when it's 100 degrees and kind of humid from the monsoons, while districts in more temperate regions start later? And why do kids going off to college from my own temple have start dates that are spread out over 7 or 8 weeks? I'm sure there's some rational reason behind this raggedly random beginning to school, but having been an educator and a school parent for many years now, and having spent 8 years on the Metropolitan Education Commission, I still have no idea at all what that reason could be. And people say the Jewish calendar is confusing. Now, that calendar I do have some insight into. It's actually sort of simple. On the Jewish calendar, there are 12 months, but they are each based on the cycles of the moon, which takes between 28 and 30 nights every month to go from new to full and back to new moon. That means that months in the Jewish year vary slightly, from 28 to 30 days, and because the lunar cycle is fully regular over 19 years, but slightly irregular over any single year of that period, the dates move a bit against the solar calendar. That means Jewish holidays, which always occur on the same exact day on the Jewish calendar, float just a little against the seasons and against the solar calendar, the secular version of which is based on the cycles of the sun, of course. So, last year, Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, began just after Labor Day. This year, it begins the evening of September 23rd. You might end up with a 3 or 4 week variance from year to year, but it all corrects every few years with a leap month added in the early spring. Okay, the Jewish calendar is confusing too. Let's leave it, saying that the final month of the 5774 Jewish calendar year is coming up this week, Elul, a month of preparations before the High Holy Days of Tshuva of Return. I can pretty well assure you, though, that however random it may seem, the Jewish calendar makes a lot more sense than the academic ones used by schools around this great country of ours. Perhaps it's all a matter of God's will, since it doesn't make sense otherwise. To play us in on that theme of God's will on this August morning, here's the Moroccan-French-Israeli singer Clara Fota singing Inshallah, God's Will. Inshallah, mon Dieu prie pour nous. Inshallah, on a besoin de toi. حن علينا c'est après toi le déluge et y a que toi qui compte c'est après toi le déluge et c'est comme ça le monde
c'est moi l'enfant qui prie. Si c'est pas moi, c'est qui? Pour tous les gens sur terre, de couleurs différentes. Et si un jour on se pardonne, avec bon cœur on donne, on n'aura jamais peur, si on a froid dans le cœur.
That was Claude Afota singing Inshallah. You know, a fascinating story was published last week in an international Saudi Arabian newspaper, Asark al-Awsat, a publication that's a mouthpiece for the royal family in Riyadh. The author was Mamoun Fandi, an Egyptian-born and educated academic now at Georgetown. He's also a U.S. media and consulting figure. Fandi declared boldly that there is no longer an Israeli-Arab conflict, but now there's an Israeli-Turkish-Iranian conflict, and so that if Israel wants to make a major peace deal with the Arabs, now is the time. He also said it would take a dramatic, bold gesture by an Israeli prime minister in order to make this happen. Under the headline, "There is no more Israeli-Arab conflict," wow, that'll get your attention, Fandi notes that the attacks on Israel now come from Gaza, and that Hamas is carrying out the mission of its non-Arab patron state of Iran, with the assistance of the Muslim Brotherhood and its patron states, also non-Arab, Turkey, and the rogue Gulf oil state of Qatar. "Even the nature of the conflict changed," Fandi wrote. "Conventional warfare, where armies of countries face enemies in the combat zone, has been replaced by asymmetrical warfare, where the army fights against guerrilla movements in the cities. The conflicts between Israel and the Arab states, led by the 1948, 1967, and 1973 wars, are no longer reality. Israel is fighting political movements now, like Hamas and Hezbollah, not Arab countries, and the patronage of these movements comes from Iran or Turkey. Of course, they are not Arab countries. The disconnection of the Arab states and the rhetoric against Hamas in the Arab world, especially in Egypt, indicates a profound change in the perception of the conflict across the Arab world. The rhetoric of the current round turned Israel against Hamas, Turkey, Iran, and Qatar. The support in the Arab world for Hamas is voiced only on Twitter and other social media forums." His article stresses that Qatar, the only Arab country that supports Hamas, is isolated from the rest of the Gulf countries. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain withdrew their ambassadors from Doha. So what was once an Arab-Israeli conflict no longer exists. "The good news is that if Israel wants to achieve a great deal with the Arabs, now is the time to do it," the Saudi newspaper article declares. "Arab countries are now in the worst political situation they have been in for some time. Given the current political upheavals, they are now ready to sign a comprehensive deal with Israel." Then Fandi notes, "The biggest obstacle here, however, is the Israeli side. Can Israel produce a Sadat-like figure willing to make a daring move in the same way that the late Egyptian president did, going to Cairo or Riyadh and signing a comprehensive deal? Perhaps an even more daring move would be to go to Tehran. The ball is firmly in Israel's court right now." The novelty of this article being run in what is usually considered to be a kind of semi-official Saudi Arabian newspaper is powerful. Published in London, this paper is owned by a member of the Saudi royal family. The points that Fandi makes, however, in his article reflect what some of us have been saying ever since the Gaza conflict started back in June. Moderate Arabs, in fact all Arab states except Qatar, have been extraordinarily quiet during Israel's military suppression of Hamas, in spite of the civilian casualties in Gaza. Even Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority has been pretty darn muted about criticizing Israel. The UN has other ideas, as do some European states, but in the Middle East and all around the Arab world, the sands of change are shifting. I believe that Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, essentially all Arab states except Qatar, wanted to see Hamas beaten badly. Israel has a rare opportunity here to make some kind of deal with Fatah, the non-Islamist Palestinians, with the strong support of the other Arab states. The Arab state's motivation here is not related to any great appreciation they have for Judaism or Israel. In fact, they're simply afraid of the popularity of radical Islamist movements and the financial and military sponsorship they're receiving from Iran and Turkey. From Israel's perspective, this might really prove to be a great political opportunity. I do not ever recall a semi-official or official Saudi Arabian newspaper supporting Arab governments in the concept of getting closer to Israel. Very interesting. You know, the stereotype for many years was that Jews had no alcoholics or drug addicts, and very few convicts. The truth is that we are subject to the same challenges of addiction that are present in the general American population, and we succumb to. Harriet Resetto realized this long ago. She's built a strong and effective Jewish response to addiction and to returning to society after Jews are imprisoned. She was awarded a 2013 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for her work with addiction and for her institution, Beit Tshuva. Hear her down-to-earth but very inspiring story when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 15th anniversary with a special family class and in new locations. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbis Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up, or go to our website, TempleEmmanuelTucson.org. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. It's free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But please, pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. Taste of Judaism has both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, East Tucson, and Green Valley, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today for Taste of Judaism.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Harriet Resetto is the CEO and founder of Los Angeles renowned nonprofit drug and alcohol treatment center, Beit Tshuva. Harriet's story is a remarkable story. She was a recipient of the 2013 Kohan Foundation Memorial Award for her work with Jewish recovery. Good morning and welcome, Harriet.
Well, thank you. Happy to be with you.
Tell us the initial story of how you began in this particular work. It was kind of a little bit of a miracle.
Well, yes. It was the first thing I ever identified as a miracle, actually. I was looking and had been looking for my mission in life for many years and had failed to find it. And at a certain low point, I went to consult someone who called herself the Expect a Miracle Lady, and she was a metaphysician. And she said, "What is it that you want?" And I said, "That's my problem. I don't know what I want. What I really want is to know what I want." And she said, "Well, I'm going to pray for you." She said, "Father of the universe, take this woman by the hand and guide her to her rightful work. She knows she wants to make a difference, but she doesn't know how." And she said, "Okay, that's it. Pay attention." And that weekend, when the classifieds came out, I was unemployed. I'm a social worker by trade and had left a job and was looking for my next place in life. And I looked under social work, which I had left a few years ago, and there was a very small ad, and it said, "Person of Jewish background and culture to work with Jewish criminal offenders." And it was my moment, you know, and in Alcoholics Anonymous, they call that a moment of clarity or a spiritual awakening. It was a wow, like I prayed and here is my thing. This is exactly where I belong. And I decided not to call it coincidence and to believe that it had been in some way divinely guided and that it was my miracle. And I started going out visiting Jewish men and women in jails and prisons, and I was hooked.
So the question is, what kind of a job is this for a nice Jewish girl?
Exactly right. And I've been asking myself that for 30 years. You know, this is a nice Jewish girl who always had some attraction to bad boys. And the fact that they were Jewish ones was pretty exciting to me. And then I ultimately married one, as I think you know.
I do. And we'll talk about that when we come back. And also the remarkable recovery rates being achieved at Beit Tshuva. When we return in just a few moments with Harriet Rossetto here on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mevinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, there's an interesting phenomenon in every Israeli war. There are songs. And many of the greatest Israeli songs have come in the aftermath of the war, just before a war. I think of Yerushalayim Shel Zahav in 67, or Lu Yehi in 74.
Ani Mavtiach Lach. Shalom,
Ani Mavtiach Lach. There are songs now from this Gaza conflict. Can you talk about them a little bit?
Yeah. I'm sure there is more than the two that I'm familiar with, but the one that really, really moved me was the one that was written for Sean, the lone soldier from Texas, Sean Nissim Carmeli, that on Facebook they were posting.
We should explain what a lone soldier
lone
is.
Lone soldier, which means an American Jew that deciding to make Aliyah and to serve at the IDF. And so he, like, even though he will have like a sister or someone in Israel, but he will, by the IDF, he will be defined like a lone soldier.
He doesn't have family there. He doesn't have parents.
Like all his family in Israel.
Right,
so,
right.
So people in Israel was afraid that since he is a lone soldier, he will have only few people, you know, just his close family and friends. So they posted all over the social media, and apparently more than 20,000 people came to his funeral.
Oh my God.
So the one of the songs that I heard was written by Ariel Horowitz, the son of Naomi Shemer, very familiar musician in Israel, and he wrote a song which says 20,000 people, Sean, walk you today in silent, two sisters, and because he has two sisters and 20,000 brothers. I really think it shows the solidarity and the unify that we have in Am Israel right now. And you know, there is a lot of bad things happening, but one good thing that start, unfortunately, with the kidnap of the three teens, a couple months ago, really brought unity and solidarity, something that we kind of forgotten. And it's really right and left, religious and secular and whatever, everyone come together because of these three teens. And now we see the powerful of this, that you know, Am Israel, kulanu arevim,
kol Yisrael arevim ze laze.
Thank you.
Which is actually from the Talmud, so it's 1600 years old, we've been saying that, but it's true. Every Jew is responsible for every
true.
Other. Still true. Thank God.
Thanks God.
So if there's something good that comes out of this, maybe it can be the unity of the Jewish people.
Yeah. And there is more songs and we will be, I guess we will hear much more songs, you know.
Of course, over time. And we'll hear them here on Too Jewish as well. Yeah. That we can do on radio as we can play music. Thanks, Oshrat. We'll
talk
next week.
Thank you,
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the ancient Christian communities of the Middle East, many of whom are seriously endangered by the wars in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere. Got to the point of the Byzantine Empire becoming Christian, although much older churches existing in places like Armenia, Georgia, and Christian communities in what today are Syria and Iraq. Mosul has been in the news very much recently. Can you explore a little bit about that?
Right. We'll focus in more narrowly on the ancient Christian communities in northern Iraq, in particular, Syria and Turkey.
So probably worth noting that the earliest Christian communities were originally Jewish communities. That's where they began to recruit the new religion,
right,
or the
well,
new.
Of course, Mosul is actually the ancient city of Nineveh, which was the capital of an empire.
The Assyrian
Empire.
That's
where the prophet Jonah prophesied, and in theory at least, is buried, and his tomb is a pilgrimage site.
And was just blown up by ISIS, supposedly.
Maybe.
We're not sure.
Who really knows?
Right.
So actually, where we left off was the conversion of the Roman Empire when Christianity became the state religion. And it was at that point that the whole Jesus story was rewritten, because prior to the fourth century, everybody knew that the Romans had crucified Jesus the way they crucified other people they regarded as criminals. But when Jesus became not only the central figure in the new state religion of the Roman Empire, but also because of the Council of Nicaea in the early 320s, Jesus was declared divine, a point on which Christians continued to disagree in many ways, definitions of the Trinity, et cetera, et cetera. But in any case, after that point, to be anything but Christian was to be other than a good citizen of Rome. It was almost treason. It was like political dissent. And life became much harder for the Jews. But of course, the unified Roman Empire didn't last very long. And by the next century, the fifth century, it was gone. It was first divided into East and West. The East had its capital at Constantinople, which eventually became Istanbul. And that eastern half of the Roman Empire lasted for a good 1,000 years beyond that, and was known as the Byzantine Empire. The western half of the Roman Empire, by the 450s, was gone. To one degree or another, in some sense or another, replaced by the Roman Catholic Church at Rome. But the political power of the Roman Catholic Church was limited at first and only expanded in the course of the next 1,000 years as the Byzantine Empire sort of waxed and waned. Now, what's interesting about these ancient Christian communities is that they were all, or at least mostly, in territories that belonged to Byzantium. The degree to which northern Iraq was ever part of the Byzantine Empire is open to question and interpretation. It was part of usually other empires with which the Byzantines were always fighting. And so the frontier was shifting. But that's that part is kind of a gray area. It may not be fair to characterize the Christians of northern Iraq as Byzantine Christians. The others certainly are, and their church architecture and melodies and everything about
mosaics
their practice
and their rituals
reflects that. And we can talk specifically about some of these communities perhaps next week.
Thanks, Tom. Fascinating subject. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe and Susie have just gotten married. On their way to the honeymoon, Moshe says to his new wife, "Would you have married me if my father hadn't left me a fortune?" And Susie replies, "Darling, I would have married you no matter who had left you a fortune." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Re'eh, the fourth sedra in the book of Deuteronomy. It follows a sequence of marvelous portions with yet another tremendous text. Re'eh includes one of the most radical statements in the whole of the Torah. Ki yevcha evyon me'achad achecha be'achad sharecha. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within one of your gates in the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother. Ki fatoach tiftach et yadcha lo. You shall certainly open your hand to him and give him enough of whatever he lacks, whatever he wants. This commandment is not simply to provide for the needs of the needy, not just to alleviate their suffering, but give them what they actually want: sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we seek to provide in our American society, in which the safety net seemingly has as many holes as net. It's more than the social protesters in Israel believe that their society is providing. It's a powerful, dramatic statement. Open your hand, and surely give the needy poor what they ought to have. This is part of the strong economic agenda of Deuteronomy. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power, and no one is to be left destitute. Most importantly, our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters is left without what they need in order to survive. Herein lies a foundational lesson on the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion, give her or him enough to live reasonably and with dignity, and to do so in a way that preserves the recipient's dignity. That's the true measure of tzedakah, of living justly and in righteousness. At its heart, Judaism is pragmatic ethics. We are trained to make the world morally better by practical action. After exploring the Talmudic dictum that even those who receive charity need to give something to those with less, the rabbis concluded that tzedakah is meant to be a percentage of income, not a hard figure. And the same percentage, whether it's 10% or 5% of gross income or another number, should be given in good times and bad. It's true that when there is less income, there will be a smaller absolute amount donated, but the percentage, and thus the integrity of the individual's morality, must be preserved. So, my friends, open your hand. Give a percentage of your gross income to help others. Do so freely and generously, in good times, in tough times, at all times. It's the Jewish thing to do. It's the right thing to do. Harriet Rossetto won the 2013 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for her outstanding work on Jewish recovery. Find out what's unique about the ways we Jews respond to addiction and how Harriet Rossetto's unique approach has helped many people rebuild their lives. When we come back, in just a moment, here on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Three significant deaths occurred last week. First, Lauren Bacall, the actress whose provocative glamour elevated her to stardom in Hollywood's golden age and whose lasting mystique put her on a plateau in American culture that few stars ever climbed to. Lauren Bacall died last week in New York. She was 89. As her son, Stephen Bogart, said, her life speaks for itself. She lived a wonderful life, a magical life. Lauren Bacall was born Betty Joan Persky in Brooklyn, New York, September 16, 1924, the daughter of William and Natalie Persky, Jewish immigrants from Poland and Romania. Her parents divorced when she was six. Her mother moved to Manhattan and adopted the second half of her maiden name, Weinstein Bacall. The screen first name of Lauren was given to Bacall by her director, Howard Hawks. Bacall was a cousin of Israeli Prime Minister and President Shimon Peres, by the way. With an insinuating pose and a seductive, throaty voice, Bacall shot to fame in 1944 in her first movie, Howard Hawks' adaptation of the Ernest Hemingway novel To Have and Have Not, playing opposite Humphrey Bogart, who became her lover on the set and later her husband. It was a smashing debut, sealed with a handful of lines now engraved in Hollywood history.
You know you don't have to act with me, Steve. You don't have to say anything and you don't have to do anything. Not a thing. Oh, maybe just whistle. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
That film was the first of more than 40 for Lauren Bacall, among them The Big Sleep and Key Largo with Bogart, How to Marry a Millionaire with Marilyn Monroe and Betty Grable, Designing Woman with Gregory Peck, Harper with Paul Newman, and Murder on the Orient Express. But few, if any, of her movies had the impact of her first, or that one scene. She did receive an Honorary Academy Award in 2009 in recognition of her central place in the golden age of motion pictures. But she was not actually nominated for a real acting Oscar until 1997, and she didn't win. The theater was very kind to Bacall, however. She won Tonys for her starring roles in two musicals adapted from classic films, Applause in 1970 and Woman of the Year in 81. She also won a National Book Award in 1980 for the first of her two autobiographies, Lauren Bacall, By Myself. Though often called a legend, she didn't like the word. It's a title and category I am less than fond of, she wrote in 1994. Aren't legends dead? Bacall also expressed impatience in her later years with the public's continued fascination with her romance with Humphrey Bogart, even though she frequently said that the 12-year marriage was the happiest period of her life. Years later, however, she seemed resigned to being forever tied to Bogart and expressed annoyance that her later marriage to another great actor, Jason Robards Jr., was often overlooked. My obit is going to be full of Bogart, I'm sure, said Bacall. If that's the way it is, that's the way it is. Bacall was an 18-year-old aspiring model and theater usher in New York when her face on the cover of Harper's Bazaar caught the eye of Slim Hawks, Howard Hawks' wife. Brought to Hollywood and taken under their wing, she won the role in To Have and Have Not. Her deep voice and the seductive way she looked at Bogart in the film attracted lots of attention. During her romance with Bogart, she asked him if it mattered to him that she was Jewish. His answer, she later said, was, "Hell no. What mattered to him was me. How I thought, how I felt, what kind of person I was, not my religion. He couldn't care less. Why did I even ask?" In most of her early movies, Lauren Bacall smoked seductively, as did so many movie stars of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, but Last week, the Surgeon General, who did more to fight cigarette smoking in America than perhaps any other man, also passed away. Dr. Jesse Steinfeld, who, as Surgeon General in the Nixon administration, spoke out against cigarette smoking, brought new attention to the risks it posed to women and to secondhand smoke. Steinfeld, born in Pittsburgh, was the son of Jewish immigrants from Hungary. His father, a smoker, died when he was 5 years old. Steinfeld's mother ran a dry goods and hardware store. He finished high school at 16, graduated college 19 months later, and he was 22 when he got his medical degree. Dr. Steinfeld had been a top official at the National Cancer Institute under Lyndon Johnson before President Richard Nixon named him Surgeon General in December of 1969. He soon developed a contentious relationship with the tobacco industry, which lobbied for his dismissal. The Surgeon General's office had been required to issue reports about smoking since the mid-60s, but with more evidence that smoking caused lung cancer and other diseases, Steinfeld made the issue his own, and his office, that of the Surgeon General, a bully pulpit. Citing studies that showed that women were less likely than men to quit smoking, he helped lead a campaign to reduce the number of female smokers. He spoke out against how tobacco companies marketed cigarettes to women, warning that smoking could be dangerous to women's health and to the health of their children, born or unborn. And Steinfeld was among the first public health officials to warn of secondhand smoke. When he became Surgeon General, he removed ashtrays from his office the previous two Surgeons General had smoked and put up signs that read, "Thank you for not smoking." Some of his ideas, including bans on smoking in restaurants, airplanes, trains, and other public places, didn't take hold for decades, but his boldness gave momentum to activists who opposed smoking and sought similar restrictions. Industry critics accused him of lying. The results of public misinformation are evident, David Peoples, the president of the tobacco giant R.J. Reynolds, wrote in a letter to Elliot Richardson, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare in 1972. Public transportation is beset with no smoking policies on the basis of the Surgeon General's arbitrary campaign to ban all smoking. Steinfeld was asked to submit his resignation after Nixon was reelected in November of 72. He lost the job because of his efforts to reduce smoking. In addition to his anti-smoking activism, Surgeon General Steinfeld spoke frequently against what he regarded as the negative effects of television violence on kids. Here, he was not so effective. Truly a man ahead of his time, Surgeon General Steinfeld helped move America away from the terrible evils of smoking. And finally, Belle Kaufman, a former New York City schoolteacher and the granddaughter of Shalom Aleichem, whose classic first novel, Up the Down Staircase, was a stunningly accurate portrait of the challenge, frustration, heartbreak, and glory of life as a teacher in an urban school when it was published in 1965, died in Manhattan last week at the age of 103 years old.
I was born in 1911. I spent my whole childhood in Odessa, 100 years apart. Nobody encouraged me to write. The whole family wrote. It was like brushing your teeth. I was just 12, I think. And I was put into a New York public school. Not a word of English, but the teacher understood. She didn't mind the fact that I didn't understand a word she said. And I thought, how kind of her. It must be pleasant to be a teacher. All the time I was teaching.
Up the Down Staircase spent more than a year on the New York Times bestseller list. It has sold more than 7 million copies, been translated into at least 16 languages, so fully has the novel entered the collective consciousness that its title, Up the Down Staircase, is still used as a catchphrase to describe absurd or impossible situations or bureaucracy. Up the Down Staircase was made into a popular movie with that name in 1967, starring Sandy Dennis as Belle Kaufman's idealistic young teacher protagonist, Sylvia Barrett. Belle Kaufman was the granddaughter of the protean Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem. With her family, she escaped Russian revolutionary Odessa in 1923 and headed for New York, eventually becoming a teacher in the gargantuan bureaucratic New York school system she portrayed and parodied. According to her close friend, a member of my congregation in Tucson, Belle Kaufman was sharp and clear right up until her death last week, at the age of 103.
My grandfather, Sholem Aleich, is known as a great humorist. But the humor was not in what happened. His humor was in what was said about it. A verbal humor. For example, he describes a man blind on one eye, myopic on the other, too poor to buy eyeglasses, who wears only the frames without any lenses. When he's asked why, he says, "It's better than nothing." And that's true.
Belle Kaufman has now ascended her final staircase. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. She's Harriet Rossetto, the founder of Beit Tshuva, the CEO and creator of an organization that does remarkable work. She with her husband, Rabbi Mark Borowitz, in helping Jews who are ex-cons and alcoholics and drug addicts to recover in a spiritual and complicated process. She's also the winner of the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for 2013 for her work in this area. Harriet, recovery is a complicated process. The most expensive and best programs in the country sometimes cite a success rate higher than they actually achieve, but even the best of them might have successful recovery, that is, no recidivism, 25% of the time. Talk a little bit about what's different about the way that Beit Tshuva approaches this complicated problem of addiction.
Well, I think that we're not treating addiction, basically, that we see addiction as a spiritual malady, an inability to somehow deal with being a human being. And the alcohol and drugs and other addictive behaviors are a misguided solution to the problem of dealing with what we see as a divided self, which is what it means to be a human being, to be a creature that's both divine and animal, and to have to integrate those parts in a way that allows you to be whole and to make good choices based on some principles higher than your own desires. And that's a very difficult thing to do, and I think we're not taught how to do that growing up. We're taught how to look good and how to keep the outsides together, but oftentimes the insides have a different life. And I think that addicts are people of extremes often. Their Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara are war with one another, and it becomes so uncomfortable that the only way they can find a sense of wholeness or integration is to medicate or anesthetize themselves or get involved in risky behaviors that distract you from your inner pain.
You know, I've always had a kind of a theory when I've worked with people with addictions, in a rabbinic way, that there's a hole inside that needs to be filled.
The hole in the soul, we call it. And that hole, I think, is the space between those extremes. Yeah, they alternate addicts between all good or all bad. And our process is to help them integrate, not alternate.
Tell us a little bit about what it felt like the first time, you started this new job as an experienced social worker, sitting in a prison across from a convict.
Well, the first experience was at the Women's County Jail, Sybil Brand County Jail in Los Angeles, and the first person I met was a woman my age who had been a graduate of Hunter College. I mean, there was
wow.
An immediate bond between us. She had a daughter the age of my daughter. And we were the same person, except she was in a red jumpsuit and I was on the other side of the glass. And that was my there but for the grace of God. Like, there are no exemptions here, you know. She's me and I'm her. And what had happened was she'd married a man who came back from Vietnam addicted to heroin, and she tried for many years to help him get clean, and at some point she joined him and started selling drugs. But, you know.
Wow. How long was it before you moved to thinking, well, I know you got a grant to start this program. Tell us a little bit about what led you to that idea and how it developed from there.
Well, I would be visiting people, and they would say, hey, I want to change my life. And I would say, okay, well, when you get out of here, come and see us. At that time, we had offices in Gateway's hospital basement. It was a program called the Jewish Committee for Personal Service in State Prisons and Mental Hospitals. It was a small little organization of rabbis and social workers that kept in touch with Jewish people when they were incarcerated or in state institutions. And so they would come, and they would be, you know, let out of jail, say, in the middle of the night. And if they'd gone in the summer and now it was winter, they'd be in shorts and tank tops with no money and nowhere to go. And I would get on the phone and try to help them find somewhere to land. And I would call every agency. And they would say, what is the long-term treatment plan? And I would say, a bed for tonight. And one day, in utter frustration, I said some nasty words and said, you know what? I'll start my own. And so we got this grant from FEMA and from the Jewish Community Foundation. And I went and bought an old house under the auspices of Gateways in East L.A., Barrio adjacent.
Wow.
And opened the door. And I was the staff. I was the only staff in the beginning. I moved in. That was before Mark.
Right.
And people started to come.
So there's a romantic quality to this story, too. Tell us how you met Mark Borowitz, how that transpired.
A couple of months after I had opened the doors, I got a call from Rabbi Mel Silverman, who was the rabbi at Chino State Prison. And he said, my congregation here, because there is a congregation in many of the state prisons, by the way, is interested in what you're doing out there with this Beit Tshuva, and they want to find out more about it and tell you what they need. So I came, and the rabbi's inmate clerk was this loudmouth named Mark Borowitz. And he was the spokesperson for the group and, you know, challenging me, like, what did I know about the needs of convicts? So I got defensive, and I said, hey, you smartass, I'm out here doing it. When you get out of here, come help me. And one day he showed up.
And the rest is history, as they say.
And then eventually we got married, and he got ordained, and we've been doing this together now for 25 years.
What's different about Jewish recovery? Is it all the same thing, just a different spin?
Well, I think when our interpretation of what a Jewish life is a life of wholeness. There are people who come here who aren't Jewish, who find the same meaning in Jewish, I call it psychology, Jewish philosophy, Jewish theology. It's about putting oneself together, integrating the opposing voices. And the other piece of it is community, feeling a sense of belonging in community. And I think any other faith group can do that. We happen to be doing it in a Jewish way.
Harriet, what, this is more of a philosophical question, but you're maybe better prepared to answer it than anybody. Why are nice Jewish people, particularly women, it seems like to me, probably a sexist comment, attracted to bad boys?
That's a really good question. Why? Because I think that there is an attraction to danger and to excitement. I think some of it's sexual. I think there's a built-in kind of rebellion, maybe, in a lot of nice Jewish boys and girls, because boys are attracted to bad girls, too.
For sure.
That it's the sense of danger and difference. I mean, nice people are boring.
Spirituality, Jewish spirituality, is a big part of what you do at Beit Tshuva. You have services. Is there any qualitative difference in the kind of Shabbat spiritual services that you guys have?
Well, I think a big piece is the music. And we have, you know, a lot of people who become addicts are incredibly talented. And I'm not sure which is the chicken and which is the egg. But a lot of musicians and a lot of creativity. And there are several things. One is that Rabbi Mark encourages people to take traditional prayers and write their own music and interpretation so that they become personal and contemporary. So a Ma Tovu might be set to a Motown sound, but it's still a Ma Tovu. And the other is that he makes Torah personal. Like, where's your Moses and you, and where do your Moses and your Pharaoh not come to terms with one another, and what are your inner slaveries, so that you see yourself in every parsha, and the prayers become personal as well, so they can be relatable, not something old and not relevant to my inner life.
The Koha Memorial Award that you received last year, I think well-deserved. Just tell us a little bit about how that gets applied, what that means.
Well, it was very exciting to me that the Koha Foundation recognized inner oppressors, because that's how we have defined addiction, as an internal rather than an external oppression. And to be recognized for that was very exciting.
When someone is in trouble, what's the best thing that they can do?
They can tell somebody. They can ask for help. Or if they can't, and they often can't, then the family sometime has to stop enabling and do the hardest thing that a family can do, really, which is say, you can't do this in my house anymore, or I'm not bailing you out, or, you know, stop trying to rescue so that the person is able to assume responsibility. That's really tough for families, particularly Jewish families, to do.
Where can people go to find more about Beit Tshuva?
We have a website, recently redone.
Very good. Mazel tov.
Do you have that address?
I don't, but I think it's beitshuva.org?
www.beitshuva.org, yes.
And try spelling it different ways, but usually it can be found by most of the
search engines. B-E-I-T-T-S-H-U-V-A-H.
And by the way, your Sacred Housekeeping, a spiritual memoir, your kind of autobiography is easily accessible and really helps to put stuff in context. So thank you for that as well.
Thank you. Thank you for recognizing me and Beit Tshuva.
It's a great privilege. Again, I want to thank Harriet Rossetto for a great visit here on To Jewish about Beit Tshuva and Jewish recovery. Thanks again, Harriet.
And thanks for your interest.
When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 15th anniversary with a special family class and in new locations. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbis Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up, or go to our website, templeemmanueltucson.org. The class includes delicious taste of traditional Jewish foods. It's free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But please, pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501.
877-327-4501. Taste of Judaism has both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, East Tucson, and Green Valley, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today for Taste of Judaism.
Thanks for being here with me this morning on Too Jewish. I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Joel Baden, Yale Divinity School professor and the author of The Historical David, The Real Life of an Invented Hero. Our playout this morning comes from the Israeli Yiddish star Chava Alberstein and the great American klezmer ensemble The Klezmatics, working together on the song The Golden Peacock, The Golden Epave. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Is the golden epave geflogen? Und die Nacht hat geöffnet die goldene Augen. Lichtiger meiner Schlafrei. Die Nacht hat